now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Bruce R. Fenton. Bruce Fenton is the author of the revolutionary Human Origins ebook series, The Forgotten Exodus. He was born in the historic English town of Cheltenham, England. He graduated from Anglia Ruskin University in 2002, having studied information systems. Fenton has earned the respect of his peers and made a name for himself in the research fields of ancient mysteries and human consciousness. A world traveler and public speaker, Fenton's research activities have also been featured in the UK's Telegraph newspaper. He was recently honored to receive an invitation to appear as a guest presenter on a popular science channel show. Fenton is a current member of both the Paleoanthropology Society and the Scientific and Medical Network. And his websites are brucefenton.info and earthforall.net. That's earth numeral four, all.net. His book is called The Forgotten Exodus, The Into Africa Theory of Human Evolution. So without any further ado, Bruce Fenton, how are you?
Thanks, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours, Bruce. This is information that is vitally important. As you know, the stranglehold the academic system has on real information, real truth, is deep-seated, institutionalized. And whenever information that's not necessarily new, but information that kind of shatters existing paradigms come along, there is this ingrained resistance on the part of the academic community to prevent this information from coming out, or at least to marginalize it. For the benefit of our listeners, Bruce, can you tell us a bit about background and how you came into this important work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been involved with, investigating and researching like mysteries of the ancient past for some 20 years. Also, mysteries of consciousness, you know, and that side of things as well. Both being sort of my two key interests for the last 20 years. Started off, I was about 11. I started reading about, you know, strange mysteries. I actually had a collection of cards. I think they're called Mysteries, Unexplained Mysteries of the World, that my grandmother gave me. And that was literally how I got into, you know, these kind of studies, was just these handful of cards, you know, things like crystal skulls and the pyramids, and had all these things on these little cards. That's how it really started. And then, you know, over time, if that progressed into a more serious investigation, and with the particular work that, you know, that I'm doing now, that's come about in the last, well, I suppose the last half a decade, where I was in Ecuador for 5 years until last year. And whilst there, actually quite early on whilst I was there, I became connected with a discovery in the jungle there, which has been given the name the Lost City of Giants, which was in a lot of, you know, popular media and also in mainstream media. I think RT covered it, and also the Telegraph newspaper covered some of my research. Basically, that site is a very particular, you know, peculiar megalithic complex in the Amazon in central Ecuador. Nobody knows who built it. Nobody knows, you know, what it's for. There's, you know, nobody lives in that actual area of jungle. You know, there's no tribes there or anything like that. So it's quite inhospitable. The temperatures fall to sort of freezing at night. You know, there's lots of fogs, mists, some swamps. And, you know, you can sort of imagine it's not somewhere people choose to live. It's notoriously dangerous. This is called the Yanganasis National Park. It's notoriously dangerous. It's an area that explorers go into looking for lost Inca gold, the treasure of Atahualpa. It's supposedly hidden in there somewhere. It's, you know, and that's why they would have hidden it there, is because it's so dangerous, you know, that the Spanish wouldn't have been able to easily find it. They would have probably died looking for it. So basically, yeah, whilst researching this site, I came to a connection with some people called the Lagoa Santa type people, which are, well, a population that was down in ancient Brazil, which has been identified as Australoid, i.e. that they have an ancestry back to Australia and, you know, Guinea, and that these people were the earliest Americans, you know. We now know that they were likely on the continent from at least about 50, 60,000 years ago. There's sort of fossil finds of them that go back at least over 13, 14, 15,000 years ago. But most of the other evidence, you know, is like rock art, some fire pits, that kind of stuff. But, you know, we know that they were there. So this was a lead in to the Australian side of things. And obviously I was in, you know, some collaboration with Stephen and Evan Strong, who you've obviously had on the show. And they sent me some of the papers on this connection between the Lagoa Santa and the, you know, the ancient Australians. So that was kind of the hook in, you know, how work in South America led to research connected to Australia and, you know, Australian origins. And obviously they made me aware of their out of Australia theory, you know, and I'd read some of their articles on their website. I mean, I hadn't read their books, but, you know, obviously they've got some articles out, you know, that various websites. So I'd read some of that. So I had an idea of, you know, what they were claiming. And I could see that there was a tie in with my research in America, you know, that obviously there's this, you know, how could there be people in South America 50,000, 60,000 years ago if the out of Africa model and all those migrations that it includes were correct? And I thought, well, it can't be. So I better check to see whether or not the Strongs are onto something. So I did my own independent investigation of, you know, evolutionary history and the early migrations, without looking at their work, because I didn't want to sort of, you know, be biased, to be honest. So all I saw was their articles, but I thought I'd do, you know, it's so important. I better do, you know, an independent study, and see what I come up with and see if this is, you know, basically a valid model. And that's how this work came about. It ended up being more than just an investigation of the Australian connection. You know, I went all the way back to 5 million years ago, really, in my work, and I've sort of moved it forward from there because of my own like OCD. I'll be honest, you know, I like to start things at the beginning. If I start something, I have a sort of an OCD. So rather than just tackling the recent, you know, more recent migrations, I did the whole, you know, the whole bloody thing, you know.
And what was the most compelling data point about the out of Australia theory, which was which really stuck out for you, that made you sit up and go, wait a minute, there's something to this?
Well, I mean, I certainly had some suspicions because of some personal, I suppose what you'd call like altered state type events, which myself and my wife had had. So we had an inkling on that sort of, you know, I guess intuitive level that there was truth to this because of some personal experiences we'd had, you know, which were in altered states and, you know, especially your past life memories and whatnot, that we'd had some strange things that had kind of already led us in that direction. So, I mean, that was kind of crucial. But then, yes, knowing that the Americas obviously was an anomaly, you know, that was another crucial data point. And I suppose some of the articles that have been coming out as well, you know, in the mainstream press, you know, that there was some obvious inconsistencies, you know, and there was, you know, I could see some red flags coming up even through the academic side that were saying that, you know, there's something seriously wrong with this out of Africa model as it exists. So, yeah, it was a multifaceted, really, my sort of surety that there was, you know, something to this. And that's, yeah, that's absolutely been validated on, you know, all those levels.
Even in the mainstream academic community, the whole notion of how North and South Africa were populated, the old story of the people migrating across a land bridge to the, you know, through the Bering Strait, I think it is, and down into North and South America. But paradoxically, mm-hmm. It's in South America where you find all these megalithic structures that are, yes, you know, just huge in scale. And one would think that if they got to North America first, you would find those in North America first, the megalithic structures.
Yes, and the oldest, you know, as we tackled a little bit earlier there, the oldest remains or the oldest evidence of humans does seem to be down in, you know, particularly in Brazil, but down into Argentina as well, into Tierra del Fuego. So, I mean, that's as far from that northern entry point as you can get. So that is anomalous, yeah, that if we were to say all these migrations came from the north, yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense that the oldest evidence turns out to be right down in the deep south of South America. So there's obviously more to this story. And you know, I would say that there's more migrations to this story. And that's why we're seeing that there's probably at least three waves of migrations into the Americas. You know, I tackle that more in the second part of my story. So it's the Forgotten Exodus is essentially three parts. It would be one larger book, which I've split into three. Basically, because I want to get the information out faster, I decided, you know, that release the first section as an ebook, and then the second, and then the third, so that people can sort of, you know, get the chunks, you know, of information into their heads in a sequel form. But the second book does cover that, covers the Into America theory, which basically I suggest that there was a first wave, which would bring probably Homo erectus or something like Homo erectus, that made its way into America. And that may well have come, you know, through the northern entry point. That's the most likely, and made its way down, and that we just haven't found much, you know, evidence of that. You know, obviously recently there was the article that came out saying, you know, 130,000 years ago, somebody was breaking open mastodon bones, you know, I think in, is it in California, I think, but San Diego, I believe, that, yeah, that so somebody was there, you know, but, and everyone's sort of up in arms. They're saying, you know, well, you know, how can this be? Why is it the only evidence of such an early, you know, date? But it's not, because we have Huatulco in Mexico, where there was, you know, dating of a site going back to 200,000 years ago or earlier. And that was well dated by a number of geological sort of scientific methods. But it was then suppressed because it didn't, you know, it didn't support this Clovis entry 13,000 years ago, which was like a, you know, a holy cow in archaeology and just all dogma. So a lot of careers got wrecked, you know, because people were willing to tell the truth. And then further down in, you know, also in Mexico, there's been discovery of a piece of Homo erectus skull, which was found by a teacher of archaeology and paleoanthropology, ironically, he goes out walking and he looks for fossils. And it's been discussed at a couple of conferences, but hasn't made its way into a peer-reviewed paper, so it gets ignored. And then further down into Ecuador, I'm aware of a couple of discoveries of what seem to be Homo erectus skulls as well. So there is a broader context for that claim that, you know, that there was people in the Americas over 100,000 years ago. So that's just one wave, you know. And then I think the next wave we're looking at is these australoids, that, you know, there were people that moved across the oceans. And I think that they may have come in from two directions. We may have had some that hopped along islands right down in the south, you know, in Antarctica, that that made their way along there and entered, you know, Tierra del Fuego. And also I suspect that there was a migration route that came via South Africa and then on again across the ocean into Brazil, because we find a lot of these people obviously in, as I say, in Brazil, in eastern Brazil. So that's to me is the second wave. And then of course we have a later, this Clovis, you know, migration.
Now, when you mentioned earlier about the aboriginal skeletons and fossils being found in North America, I think the Strongs have talked about this as well. You're referring to skeletal remains of people who seem to have come from, because they have the anatomical and skeletal likenesses of people from Australia.
Yes, that's right. I mean, they've done the they call it the morphological analysis, where they look at, you know, the structure of the skull, and, you know, there is a particular structure that, you know, they call australoid, which basically is, yeah, like Oceanian peoples, i.e. like the people of Guinea and the people of Australia and some of those, the surrounding islands. So they match that type.
Yes, that's quite a paradox, and that's shattering those paradigms, because somehow they go from A, i.e. Australia, to Z, the Americas, and which stands the whole out of Africa theory on its head.
Yeah, this is really problematic, because, you know, in the, part of the out of Africa theory is that conventional entrance into the Americas, that it's, you know, the last continent that's explored, you know, just sort of 13,000 years ago or less. You know, so that again is just another part of the out of Africa model, that general model of human origins and early migrations, which has been, you know, catastrophically impacted by, you know, recent information that it just, you know, it's, to me, that is just now shown to be nonsense, because, you know, we're finding these, well, at least two sets of earlier migrations, like I say, you know, at least somebody was there in the very remote past, you know, going back over 100,000 years ago. And then we also find evidence, yeah, of these sort of Australian types that are there around 50,000 or 60,000 years ago. I would say, yeah, probably around 70,000, but I mean, we're at the moment it's about 50-60 is getting, you know, more strong support, but I think we're going to find that date going back a bit, and I have my reasons to suspect that. I think that this is part of the migrations that's underway around 74,000 years ago, which is essentially, which we can get into a bit later why that happened. But I think that it's part of a greater event that's going on, you know, on the planet at that time, which is why I'm drawn to that particular date, which, you know, we're going to talk a bit more about, because that comes up in my other, you know, Into Africa work as well. So I think that, yeah, we have a major movement of people at that time, including into the Americas. And I think, yeah, this is all going to become very apparent when you look at my logic in the other body of work. So yeah, there's a lot going on in the Americas too, you know, and the only reason why it's not in this book is because it's the focus of the sequel. But yeah, it certainly is, you know, a key part of my work. And, you know, as I say, a lot of this really has come out of my involvement with the site in Ecuador. So all of this really stems from mysterious sites in the Amazon jungle. You know, this is what's led to it. So it's, you know, is an American continent sort of focus underneath all of this. And that the Inter-Africa theory really started off just as me providing a foundation to my book on this site, you know, and it expanded because of my, as I say, I've got a bit of an OCD and I go a bit far sometimes with things. And instead of just writing a chapter introducing, you know, his evolution and now let's move on to my study in Ecuador, I ended up writing this, you know, enormous kind of enormous preamble, you know, to that material, which has become in its own right, you know, a sort of separate ebook, which, yeah, really tackles the whole story. You know, I go back to 5 million years ago, you know, which is obviously way before any of these sort of migration events that, you know, of the America, you know, to do with the Americas or to do with, you know, Europe and all the rest. Well, yeah, initially, it's more Africa, but a bit of Asia in it at the very beginning. But I mean, it's certainly, yeah, it's only later on that we start to tackle this story of the Americas and, you know, the colonization of Eurasia.
Now, at the outset, you mentioned, and you just mentioned a moment ago, about how key events in your life centered around the Amazon, and maybe there was a metaphysical, mystical aspect to it as well. Could you tell our listeners how you managed to come across that megalithic site in Ecuador, which is hidden there in the dense jungle, which, up to that point, hadn't been found by anyone from the so-called West? Were you advised of the location by some of the natives, or did you tune into it mystically first, and then, you know, in your physical embodiment, you went looking for it? How did that process unfold?
No, I had some of those sort of things a bit later, but initially, no, it was a kind of a strange thing. But I mean, we'd only been in Ecuador, I think, for maybe a couple of months, and we were having some issues go on, which were certainly of an esoteric nature. You know, for those that, you know, believe or aware of those kind of things, we had some negative energy events going on, which were to do with somebody that had a specific intention on me, you know, being killed or certainly having my life destroyed, and was paying people to do, you know, activities, rituals and whatnot against me. So there was a very specific negative energy type situation going on for me. And amongst trying to solve that, you know, I was looking to work with a couple of different healers and shamans and stuff in Ecuador. And one of those that we'd connected with and had some conversations with had sort of said, you know, we're going to be in town, you know, the weekend. Do you want to meet up with us? And, you know, that we're going to be meeting up with another couple. But, you know, come and have lunch and we'll have a chat and, you know, talk about some of the stuff that's going on. And so we went to that meeting and, you know, and the other couple that was there, funnily enough, because they, you know, they obviously had something they wanted to discuss with this shaman as well. But we all got talking, and it was one of them. It was the sort of the husband of the couple that he said that they'd just come back from an expedition into the Amazon, and that they'd been, you know, to this site. They'd been looking at this strange megalithic complex that they'd heard about. Basically, they'd seen a picture of it somewhere, you know, from the discoverer, who I now understand who that was, who had been there a few years before, and they'd seen a photo, so they knew it existed, and they'd gone in and they'd managed to find initially a separate part of the site, and that the area they were looking for, they got a bit lost. They found another part, so we know it's an extensive site, and they found a whole load of tools, and then they'd gone back in, they said, and then managed to get to the main megalithic complex, and had seen, you know, so two parts of the site, and they'd sort of told me about it, and that's where the initial giants thing came from, because the guy said, like, I believe it's a lost city of giants, because there's giant-sized hammers and, you know, very strange artifacts there. And so, you know, I became involved in it from that. You know, I was told about it, but yeah, it was strange in the fact that I found out by going to a meeting with a shaman, you know, and that these people were there. So it all seemed a bit, you know, like meant to know about it. Yeah, perhaps. Synchronicity. And consider that I was probably the only English-speaking researcher of ancient mysteries within, you know, hundreds of miles of those people, you know, and that somehow, you know, I'm at the same meeting with this same shaman with them just a couple of weeks after they've been to the site, and that, you know, I'm told about it, and I've only been in the country for a couple of months. So it certainly felt orchestrated that, you know, I was supposed to know about it. I mean, it was just too odd, you know, that of all the people for that information to go straight to, the only English speaking, you know, ancient mysteries researcher for, you know, a long distance.
And how long after this meeting with these people, along with the shaman, did you make it out there? Did you venture out there on your own?
Well, we had a lot going on for the next year, so I don't think it was within that first year. Initially, a lot of what I did was, you know, not research directly on site, but, you know, I certainly spoke to people. I did a bit of investigation, you know, without going. Initially, you know, my sort of research built up with, you know, interviewing some of the researchers that have been there, you know, some of the Ecuadorian sort of investigators, the explorers, and, you know, getting a bit of a background to the area and trying to find out more, you know. So I did a lot of that. You know, I ended up meeting with, you know, high level members of the Ministry of Culture, which are responsible for ancient sites in Ecuador. We had a top level meeting in the ministry with archaeologists, the director, and all this stuff. And my wife basically did all the talking because my Spanish is not great. But yeah, we did all that, and there was an agreement that they would go in and investigate. That, you know, they saw the photos, they knew there was artifacts, and they were saying, you know, obviously this is a real site. There's artifacts that need to be protected. There was a lot of that. You know, lip service was paid, and that they eventually went there, did a very brief trip, and then they said that there was nothing to be seen there. That it was just a natural site, which was just mind bending because there's piles of artifacts there, James. So it doesn't make any sense to say it's a natural site, because unless stone hammers have started growing on trees, then, you know, it's just a nonsense. So they just didn't want to work there. I think partly because it's hard to get into the site. You know, you've got to go through swamps and jungle. It probably was a bit of laziness. But also one has to wonder, and is it just covering up the paradigm shift, you know, that if we tackle this, you know, we're going to have to open a whole can of worms. It's easier just to say there's nothing there. So, I mean, I think there's a bit of both involved in that. But that's what led to me to going, to be honest. It was just that I tried other avenues. I tried to get other researchers to go. I tried to pass it on to scientists and explorers, and like nobody really was taking it seriously enough. So I thought, you know, I've got to go myself, haven't I? You know, otherwise this is not going to get documented and it's just going to get forgotten about. And so that's what led to my expeditions there. I did two expeditions to the site before I'd left Ecuador. I was able to sort of video and, you know, take photos and whatnot. So, you know, I've got a decent record of what's there, you know. And then from there, I followed up with further research into, you know, who could have built the site and who couldn't have, you know, basically looking at the Incas and the local Pantaleo sort of Neolithic cultures and stuff. So, I mean, I did all of that. And yeah, and in the end, really, it leads to these Lagoa Santa type people. I mean, there's specific historical claim that the town nearest to that site was founded by Lagoa Santa people that had made their way up through the Amazon, following one of the rivers, I think it's the River Napa, up through the Amazon to Banos de Agua Santa, which is the nearest town. And skulls of Lagoa Santa type people were found in a cave about 100 years ago, near to the site. So we know, again, that there's this further confirmation that they were there. And it's a real long way. You know, if anyone wants to look on a map and they look at Lagoa Santa in Brazil, and if they look at Banos de Agua Santa in Ecuador, you'll see that now to get there, you'd have to cross through, you know, thousands of miles of like the Amazon jungle. I mean, it's got to have happened at a time when that jungle was not the way it is now. And we know in the past it was plains and savanna, but we're going back thousands and thousands of years.
Approximately how many thousand years ago would that have been when the terrain would have been markedly different?
Mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say that this is a pre-12,000 years old site, put it that way. So this is going back to the pre-Clovis. So I know that the Amazon jungle only grew after a climate shift. I'd have to pull it up from my material to get the exact dates, but we're definitely going back to that pre-Clovis period. So when these people could have literally kind of just wandered up, you know, it's still a long way, but I mean, obviously it's more viable when you're not having to hack your way through jungle, you know, and stepping on snakes and deadly spiders and all the rest. You know, it's like, we know the Amazon jungle is incredibly dangerous to wander through. So yeah, for a culture just to suddenly make that move, you know, and to be another thing, it wouldn't be a quick move. They must have gradually migrated up. It's a long way to migrate. So again, it talks about how long these people were in the continent, that they expanded all the way from Brazil up to Ecuador and whatnot. So, and the site is of a style, you know, that is these polygonal multi-sided blocks that fit together, you know, without a razor blade passing between them and all that. The same that we see in Peru and Bolivia, except it's in the Amazon, you know, and it's a site which is not attributed to the Inca or to anybody. So this is, it's a bit of a smoking gun, you know, because we all kind of know in the old research that the Inca did not build these sites. You know, you only need to cast your eye at, say, Sacsayhuaman and see the Inca repairs on the top of the bigger blocks to know that theory is a nonsense. That, you know, you can't stand there and say, this is all Inca stonework, you know, because you'd have to be a moron. Unfortunately, archaeologists are acting like morons because they stand there and say, well, look, this is all Inca stonework. But we can see, you know, 20-ton perfectly made blocks and then dry stone walling, which like you or I could do, James, you know what I mean, on the top. It's like, don't tell me that this is the same builders, because this is nonsense.
Now, for the benefit of our listeners, could you explain what you mean by Clovis?
Yeah, basically the culture in the Americas around 13,000 years ago is attributed to a certain stone tool technology called Clovis points. And that's where the name Clovis culture comes from, is their basically their tool, you know, their tools that they use is a specific type of stone tools. They call the other Clovis technology or Clovis points, which, you know, we identify some of these ancient Stone Age cultures by the way they manufactured their cutting tools and their, you know, their spearheads and, you know, whatnot. So that's where that Clovis thing comes from. And they're supposedly, you know, East Asian type people that migrated from across Beringia, you know, around about 13,000 years ago. And then they spread all the way down through North America, down into South America. And so they're identified at sites across the continent as this Clovis type people, who are then seem to be wiped out during the Younger Dryas, you know, that around about that, I think it's about, I suppose about 12,000 years ago or so, that, you know, this culture, you know, gets whacked or whatever by the disasters. And so, yeah, so there's the Clovis culture.
The Clovis culture, I take it, would that be regarded as kind of a hunter-gatherer kind of society? They were not agriculturalist? Mm-hmm.
Supposedly so, yes, that they are given this hunter-gatherer, you know, title. But again, there's a whole argument going on now here about whether or not hunter-gatherers really, you know, really sort of existed. In some senses, there's a book called The Myth of the Hunter-Gatherer. And I know in Australia specifically, there's a couple of books on the claims that, you know, Australian Aboriginals were hunter-gatherers. There's one which is Dark Emu, and another book called, I think it's the Biggest Estate on Earth, where, you know, a lot of evidence is coming out now that showing that a lot of these populations that have been called hunter-gatherers were in fact farming, you know, and that in truth, as far as we can see back into history, humans have largely relied on, you know, eating, you know, grain and stuff. So it's becoming a bit of a farce to say that we were these sort of hunter-gatherers. It seems that I think that for much longer than anyone wants to admit, we've relied a lot on, you know, farming of some sort, or at least, I guess, adapting jungle environments and forests and whatnot so that we can use them to produce food and that stuff. So I think this is something as well that's going to come up. But yeah, we would say they were hunter-gatherers. Whether that's fully true, I guess, yeah, is also to question, because they're finding even in the Amazon jungle, that a lot of the Amazon jungle, that there is a higher than expected proportion of plants that produce food that best suits humans, you know, amongst the general background. And they think that the Amazon jungle was being farmed for thousands of years as well. So I think that there's going to be more revelations in that direction, that we're going to start seeing this idea of hunter-gatherers beginning to fade a bit.
Yeah, I can see how such a designation could be utilized to keep everything kind of in a stasis, kind of like a neutral state, similar to like in ancient Egypt or in Egyptology, where everything is written off as funerary text or structures are written off as tombs, right? There's kind of a generic understanding that's brooded about by the academics to kind of keep everything at this kind of like neutral state. Like if you just write off a whole group of people as hunter-gatherers, then it goes without saying that they could not be possibly responsible for all these big megalithic structures, and especially if the megalithic structures predate the hunter-gatherers, you see? So yes. it's a conundrum for them.
Yeah, it is. And you're right, because if you say hunter-gatherer, it implies that they were not sort of stationary and able to supply the food needs to stay in one place whilst building megaliths, you know. So there is a kind of an implicit accusation there against any culture that it basically says, you know, well, they didn't achieve anything. You know, these are just hunter-gatherers. They don't do anything else but hunt game and gather, you know, wander around gathering seeds and berries and, you know, and hunting animals and basically eking out a survival, you know, and that they can't do anything else. So therefore, they're of no real consequence in history beyond, you know, that they fill in some of the spaces in time. But we know now that if we look at, say, Göbekli Tepe, you know, which we have this 12,000-year-old site, you know, it was always believed that in that region 12,000 years ago, there was just hunter-gatherers, you know, and they couldn't, again, that there wouldn't be any megaliths there. And then they uncover, you know, this enormous sprawling megalithic site that dates to the same period as these supposed, you know, hunter-gatherers who couldn't have built anything. And yeah, so again, I think that that's a myth, you know, that we have to start accepting that people were able to, you know, I guess, cater the environment to their needs and hang around building megaliths, you know, well beyond, you know, that 6,000 years ago when we used to believe was the start of that kind of, you know, big building projects. But we now see that that's not true, that, you know, they were doing it at least 12,000 years ago. So there's no reason to think that they couldn't have been doing it in the Americas 12,000 years ago or anywhere else, you know, and we have to completely rethink that and say if they did it in Göbekli Tepe, there's no reason why they weren't doing it everywhere else. And that now we can look at those sites in the Americas again and say, well, you know, if the Incas and stuff are saying that we didn't build these sites, they're so old that they're basically, you know, the gods did it or the giants did it, or, you know, we don't know, you know, basically, but obviously someone more powerful than us did this because we can't do it. That we need to really think, well, how far back is it that it's so far back that they don't know anymore who it was? They just have, you know, legends left. So yeah, again, I think we have to really look at that period again at 12,000 years ago when the world went into a cataclysm and say, well, look, you know, these big megalithic sites, probably all, you know, certainly the mysterious ones that we don't know the builders, probably all come from that period. At least, you know, if not way older.
And their size and their scale and their construction implies kind of a lost knowledge, a lost technology. This is exactly what people like Graham Hancock talk about, who wrote the foreword for your book. Do you get the impression that these megalithic sites, like the one in Ecuador, is the product of some kind of advanced, by our standards, understanding of engineering and scientific principles?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, he's in Graham Hancock's book, The Magicians of the Gods, you know, he makes some comparisons there to like Roman technology, you know, that the Romans were able to build, you know, some enormous megalithic sites. So I think that we are talking about a civilization that is at least comparable with Roman level technology, you know, and that may not mean that there wasn't more advanced, you know, levels of civilization as well. But I think at that period around 12,000 years ago, possibly because of the environmental events that have been underway, perhaps, you know, a more advanced civilization had fallen down to a Roman level. You know, we don't know, but whoever was building these structures had at least that level of know-how and technology that we see in the Roman Empire, that they were able to build, you know, obviously we see things like the Colosseum and stuff. We know that the Romans could build incredible megalithic type structures, you know, that without, you know, without problem, they could say, you know, we just want to build an enormous structure here, we will do it. You know, if we want to do it, we can achieve it. And they would, you know. And I think we have to say that whoever was doing these projects, you know, had at least that level of engineering skill and that technology and know-how. You know, it's not something you can just overnight say, well, I'm going to build Sacsayhuaman tomorrow. You know, I'm going to, you know, build this enormous fortress. Come on, guys. You know, we've never done this before, but let's just throw it up. You know, I don't think that's viable. So we have to talk about, you know, a culture that had a long history of learning to work with stones, you know, smaller stones first, perhaps, and then larger and larger. And also that I would say had a knowledge of things like, you know, mortar, and possibly, you know, concretes and all the rest of that, that there's, you know, there's evidence that they were, you know, some of the stones, I mean, it's pointed out in Graham Hancock's book that at least some of the stones in South America, you know, have evidence of having been superheated, that there's limestone, which has signs of having been basically superheated, because some of the small particles, the shells like that make up the limestone, had basically sort of vanished. They've dispersed into the stone, which they said is just like a signature of being superheated. And that yet at the quarry where this limestone is supposedly coming from, you know, you see those small fossils in the stone. So it looks like something's being done when the stone is being mined. And between then and the structures being built, something has been done, you know. Now, whether that's the creation of some sort of artificial concrete of the stone or what, you know, it's not 100% clear, but there's obviously something going on there if it's involving superheating, you know. So somebody knew a way of, I guess, making the building process more efficient and easier, that involves this, you know, this unknown mysterious process. So that implies, you know, a technological and engineering know-how that's been lost that the ancients were using.
You mentioned a little while ago that there were some, I think three migration waves, and one of them about 200,000 years ago, if memory serves. Was there some kind of compelling climactic reason which was the impetus for all these migrations for all these different people around the world at that time? Was there something that compelled them to do that?
Yeah, I think throughout the the prehistoric timeline, that we are seeing some, you know, big climatic events that's driving a lot of the movements. I mean, I can go back a bit further if you like. I mean, it's,
yeah, please.
If we go back to around about 1.2 million years ago, I mean, I'll give you a quick rundown actually of how I see the timeline. If you want, going back from the start,
absolutely,
I'll just do a quick run through. You know, because I started off obviously at 5 million years ago. You know, we have this evidence that, you know, basically the first division between the ancestors of chimpanzees and other primates and humans is supposed to have occurred. And so that's why I start there. I mean, the first thing I'll just say quickly to people as well is that, you know, it's now being admitted by some of the leading academics that we really don't have any more evidence to say that the ancestor then was more ape-like than it was human-like, you know. And this is something we all learned at school, that, you know, it was this tree swinging, you know, ape that was our ancestor. But now they're admitting, you know what, we don't have the evidence to say that that's true, and it may well have been a human-like ancestor that gave birth to both us and the modern primates, which is, I think people need to first get their head around that, because that's a really important admission that, you know, this idea of that first, you know, ape-like ancestor is also really kind of just an invention, but it's a convenient invention. It's not well supported, and in fact, if you look at the primates, you know, you look at say gorillas and chimpanzees and stuff, you know, for quadrupedic animals, i.e. walking on four legs, they have a very peculiar way of moving, this knuckle walking. And he said that if you look at that, actually it looks rather like a change in a bipedal animal that has gone back towards four-legged movement. It doesn't look, you know, it's not like how we see sheep and cows and wolves. You look at how they run on four legs, and then if you look at how the primates move on four, you know, it's pretty odd, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's not how you'd expect a four-legged animal to move around. So there's anomalies there that suggest that they may actually descend from a bipedal, more human-like ancestor, which I suspect is true. And then what we see is around about, well, between 5 million and 3.3 million years ago, there's a few, you know, creatures which are being suggested as ancestors of ours. But I'm going to say that, you know, for me, all of the ones they've found so far appear to me to be ancestors of primates, you know, of the modern primates, not of humans. It's only around 3.3 million years ago when we see this Australopithecus, which is the first being that really can use tools and is showing, you know, what we'd say human-like behavior. And until very recently, that was only taken back to 2.5 million years ago. So in my book, I mentioned that there's been some discoveries at Lake Turkana in Africa, which show that there was tool use 3.3 million years ago. And that's where I say the start of the human timeline really begins, because we know that somebody was there, you know, cutting up meat with tools. And very recently, I've uncovered as well that there's evidence in India 2.5 to 3 million years ago that somebody there was also doing the same thing. So this is a controversial finding, because we've got almost at the same period, we've got somebody down all the way down in India, you know, doing the same thing. They found both stone tools and cut bones at a site there at Masol in India. And people can have a look at that. So we can't even be sure that the first humans were in Africa. I mean, although I've given that the prime position in my work, it's only because, you know, I'm limited to what the scientific evidence will provide if I'm going to keep the book scientific. But I hadn't uncovered at that time, you know, when I wrote this, that in fact, there's a very close dating in India for this event, which further suggests that we need to be looking in that direction for the origins. And then after that, we have the sort of important beginning of colonization of the planet, which is with Homo erectus around about 2 million years ago. And we find Homo erectus is at Lake Turkana again in Africa, but he's also in Georgia up in the Caucasus Mountains at 1.8 million years ago. And he's way down in Indonesia around 1.8 million years ago. And Homo erectus is basically the first global human species. And he really takes sort of pole position in the book in that, you know, he's the best, you know, the best, I suppose, example of what probably was the immediate ancestor of Homo sapiens. And we see him sort of obviously colonizing the planet, and then something very sort of special happens. And this is that we're going to the first of these climatic shifts, because around about 1.2 million years ago, there's a climatic disaster of some sort. Like, we don't yet know what it was, and the geologists are still trying to, you know, figure this out. But by looking at the genetics of humans, we detect these what they call bottlenecks in parts of the genome, where we can see that there's been a collapse in population numbers at some point. And we know that around that period, something happened that caused a massive die-off, and it left just a few thousand humans of any sort, you know, on the planet. What that was, I don't know. Hopefully we'll find out. But it's funny that, you know, about just 200,000 years after that is when we see the next sort of important event in my work, which is this movement in Indonesia, where somebody starts sailing. You know, they end up on Flores, which is an island cut off by deep water trenches. So, you know, you can't just walk across. Even during the Ice Age, you know, it was still cut off, and you had to take about, I think it's about three or four journeys by sea to get there. You know, you need watercraft of some sort, you know, most likely a raft, you know, like a bamboo raft tied with, you know, vines would do the job, as long as it's relatively big and you did multiple journeys or there was a few of these raft, you know, you could get a sufficient population across to Flores. So that's a key moment, you know, for these people, because suddenly you've got, you know, engineering technologies, stuff that are not supposed to be going on until 50,000 years ago with modern humans entering Australia. So, I mean, you know, obviously the academics are not loving this idea that instead of 50,000 years ago, you know, human-like behavior is already underway a million years ago. And like, to build a raft, you know, I think, James, that you want to sort of be able to communicate with the people with you, don't you? Because yes. Like, how do you really explain to like your, you know, your savage, wild monkey man friends that you want to sail across this stretch of ocean in front of them and to some island in the distance? Like, how do you explain that? And how do you explain, you need to build a big raft and I want to move us all across there? Like, if all you can do is like jabber and point at the sea, you know, I mean, it's really hard to believe that happened without some kind of intercommunication happening. So I think we're also seeing the evidence of the first language.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps an understanding of celestial navigation and knowing yes. the positioning of the stars and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because how are you going to, you know, if you're going to end up out there on the sea at night or whatever, how are you going to sort of carry on towards the island? Because I mean, at least one of these journeys is said to be about 100 kilometers or something. So I mean, I'm assuming it's going to have been at least partially at nighttime. So yeah, how do you keep finding your way ahead? Unless you know the stars and you've been watching them whilst migrating on land, you know, you've learned over the centuries that you can use them to find out which way you're going at night. So it does imply that, and it implies that we were, you know, cognizing, we were looking at the sky, we were looking at the stars, we were understanding that there was celestial movements, and we were able to take that and apply it to a project, you know, and say that we're going to cross the ocean. Don't worry, because at night we can use the stars, you know, and to explain that to the group. So, I mean, somebody is communicating ideas, and somebody is also using engineering know-how to create rafts that will carry a sufficient number of people across at least, you know, four ocean journeys to get to Flores a million years ago. So this is a really important part, and that follows that climatic event. So it's possible the two are related, that this migration perhaps is to look for somewhere that's not affected. You know, it may well be that they were driven that way. We can't know that, but it does make you wonder, doesn't it? You know, that it's right after this dramatic, you know, event, and that there's this big drop in population numbers, and then some people make this extraordinary journey. So Could the two be related? Yeah, quite possibly. And the fact that there's a low population number also is relevant because, you know, soon after this, we get to some of the, you know, the strange diversion, you know, the divergences in the human genome where we see multiple lineages emerge. And one thing that does happen during these die-offs is that if you have a mutation during a period in which there's not many people, that mutation spreads much faster and becomes, you know, a factor in more people in a very short time. Because say, if you've only got like 1,000 people, it doesn't take many generations for a significant mutation to move through that population. You know what I mean? Whereas if you've got millions of people and only a few people have a mutation and it's passed on, it never really spreads that far. So this is why we sometimes see at these bottlenecks, we see sudden jumps, either positive or negative. Like they can cause the extinction of a species, you know, if it's a negative mutation. But if there's something positive that comes about, you know, that will be passed on very fast to a large percentage, and it can make, you know, a leap in evolution happen in a very short time. And I suspect that that's part of what's happens around this time, that we're seeing some dramatic changes to humans. And really, yeah. So this is and also, of course, we're down in Southeast Asia. We're moving into a key area of my work, of the theory, that a lot's going on really down in this region, you know, because we know that Flores is on the wrong side of a geological divide there, which they call the Wallace Line, which is basically the natural divide between Australasia and Southeast Asia, because of basically there's some very strong currents that move through that region, that move down from the north to the south, just sweeping through Indonesia. So typically life can't pass the boundary. You know, a few things like rats and stuff have managed to swim across on, you know, on debris or whatever, but you know, it was one of the first times, you know, a large mammal has managed to cross, you know, which is, you know, these early humans has crossed the Wallace Line. And is now in spitting different distance of Australia, you know, a continent that's supposed to be empty for hundreds of thousands of years. Instead, you have to sort of ask yourself, well, if they're on Flores, you know, and they're a short distance away and the sea levels are lower, so you've got much more land there to, you know, to get to. You've got this, the coastal area of Australia has expanded far closer to Flores, you know, at that time. So you don't have to make a huge journey, no bigger than the other journeys you've already made to get to Flores if you've moved from Indonesia. So why wouldn't they cross in? And there, you know, this is an assumption that is made for humans that, you know, once we cross the Wallace Line, that of course we moved into Australia because it's right there. So why can't we then apply that to these early hominins? You know, if they've made it across this Wallace Line, of course they should have made it to Australia. It's the same thinking the academics apply to the later Homo sapiens, you know, supposed migrations. So we can almost certainly say that these hominins were in Australia by a million years ago.
Well, according to the lore of the original people of Australia, if I'm correct, they feel they've been here for at least a million years.
Yes, I mean, they're saying that, you know, that they've always been there. And a million years is pretty good for always, isn't it? I mean, you know, when we look at the human story, I mean, you know, a million years is most of that story. So, I mean, it is quite right for them to say, you know, we've always been here, because, you know, you can't say that about anywhere else. So, and also, I mean, there's, you know, although I don't write about it, there is the remaining chance that we were always down there. And, you know, again, I'm using the evidence that's available so that I can make this a strong scientific argument. But, you know, mark my words that there's a good chance that as the evidence keeps coming out, we may find out that in fact, all of this story goes back to Australia and goes back millions of years. And my reason for saying that is that if you look at the history of primates themselves, that if you go back to about 34 million years ago, the primates that are considered to be ancestral to humans and, you know, chimpanzees and all of the primates, they were down in Southeast Asia, you know, in Australasia and all across that area. And we know we see the orangutan, of course, is still there today. But that there was a climatic event then which led to a migration to Africa from Asia. So this is like a cycle of repeating movements, you know, from Asia to Africa, Africa to Asia. And that at that stage was the first time these primates moved into Africa. So even at the very beginning, you know, the ancestors were in that region. And then you have to ask yourself, well, did they all move to Africa, James? Because we don't know for sure. Maybe some of those primates remained down in Australasia and in that region, and that they, in fact, evolved there, and that all we're seeing in Africa is waves of migrations from Australasia through Southeast Asia and up into Africa. And again, I'll go back to that discovery in India. You know, if you think if there was someone there 3 million years ago, could not that be remnants of another of these migrations up from Australasia heading into Africa that these Australopithecus actually come from down there? And it's ironic, Australopithecus means the southern man. And, you know, yes. Obviously Australia and Australopithecus. And I think that those two terms will eventually become married. I think they were going to see that Australopithecus really was Australian. And that is a strong suspicion. I can't support it yet. So it's not argued in my work. I do just mention some of this, you know, very briefly, but because I can't support it. But the evidence is growing that suggests that, yeah, maybe we were always there and that these migrations have been going up to Africa. And we see another migration later with Homo erectus. Homo erectus has been theorized to have evolved outside of Africa, not just by me. I've seen at least about three academics that have suggested that, you know, in the past, have said that they suspect that perhaps the evolution of Homo erectus was in Asia and that then it moved up into Africa. And these finds in Georgia, in the Georgian Republic, they further suggest that because, you know, you've got a 1.8 million year old remains of Homo erectus in the Georgian, you know, mountains, which was not something that the out of Africa model would have ever expected. Because that's pretty much contemporaneous with the earliest finds in, you know, at Lake Turkana. I mean, so there's definitely something wrong there, you know, with that model. And I would say that, yeah, it's starting to slide towards a model in which we could actually equally argue that these people are moving up from, you know, from Southeast Asia and that direction. Also, if you look at the Floriensis, these hobbits, you know, you may have seen in recent articles that they're mysterious, they're little and all the rest of it. At first, they were arguing that, you know, these were, okay, some sort of Homo erectus cut off on an island and that went through island dwarfism, meaning that they didn't have enough, you know, food, so that the taller, bigger ones died off because they couldn't get enough energy. And then eventually they became smaller and smaller.
It's really reaching, isn't it?
It is reaching. And the thing is as well, if you think about it, you know, like if you're the bigger one, like, I think you could get the food off the little ones.
That's right. Give me that drumstick,
yeah, come on.
You know?
I'm just going to starve and let you little guys, you know, eat all the food. Like, no way. We're not like other animals. That's not the way we are. We don't just forage around and die because we didn't get enough food because we were too big. We look at the others and say, I am so hungry. If I have to, I'm eating you. So you're better off giving me your food before I kill you. And that's how humans, I'm sorry, but that's, you know, that's humans in a corner, isn't it? You put them in a corner and they will turn nasty. And if you're the 7 foot guy and the others are 4 foot tall, like you're going to eat the whole island's food, aren't you? Like realistically. I mean, so I don't believe that at all. I don't think that happened. And then on top of that, what they found was that when they looked, they actually discovered some older fossils that, you know, also of these Homo floresiens. And what they found was that, in fact, they were smaller in the beginning and that they'd actually got bigger. So, you know, so it totally undermined the hypothesis of island dwarfism. So, yeah, in fact, their ancestors were even shorter. So they obviously arrived on the island as quite small, you know, and this has led to another revision that now they've realized that probably the anatomy suggests that they are closer related to these like Australopithecus type, you know, humans, the really early ones, which again suggests like, what are those really early humans doing down in Indonesia, James? Isn't it?
Yes.
Unless they're coming up from like Australasia or something, because again, it's starting to further support this idea that some of the very earliest forms of humans are way, way, way from Africa. And like, what are they doing all the way down there? Cause they're not supposed to have been able to sail or talk or anything. And another problem you have is that the easiest way to reach Flores is not from mainland, like Asia, from, you know, from where we put Homo erectus in Java. It's in fact, it's easier, much easier to reach it from the north, which like Sulawesi, than the next island along, because the currents would take you from Sulawesi to Flores really like quite easily. You know what I mean? If you hopped on a log, it could float you across, that kind of thing. Whereas if you're going the other way, you're going against the currents. And like to reach Sulawesi and stuff from Australia, it's really not that hard either. So there's a question there, isn't it? Of like, well, if you're going to start applying Occam's razor and you say like, what's the easiest direction for these people to be moving? It's not from Asia to Australasia. It's more likely they, you know, in that logic, you'd say, well, it looks like they're coming from the other way. They're moving from the east to the west rather than moving from the west to the east. So there is an underlying argument here that eventually we may get to a point where we have to just say, oh, the Aboriginal Australians were right. We were always there. It's not even just a million years, that right back to these, you know, primate ancestors. And these primates may have been very, some of them, like I say, very human-like primates, again, because that's an area that's being undermined. We don't know what these first ancestors looked like over 5 million years ago, you know, that they may have been human-like, you know. But that, yeah, that we were possibly always in that region. And I know I'm going out on a limb here a bit with beyond the evidence, you know, because of course, you know, people can turn and say, well, you know, you haven't got a strong case on that. And I said, well, no, I haven't. That's why I haven't argued it strongly in the book. But I just want your listeners to be aware that that evidence is probably going to filter through in the next few years. And that I'm very open to that, you know, but I'm being cautious in the work. So that the academics can't easily dismiss the work and say, oh, you know, he's reaching here. He can't support that. So I don't argue that. I've gone along with some of their material and said, yeah, okay, probably it was in Africa at the start. But certainly the interesting stuff, you know, for Homo sapiens is definitely happening down in Australasia and Southeast Asia.
Now, you mentioned Java, man. That was another name for Homo erectus, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How long ago did they find, quote unquote, how long did they ago did they date, you know, Java man? And, you know, keeping in mind that sometimes the dating methods back then may not have been, you know, up to our modern day standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, they reckon that, yeah, Homo erectus have been in Indonesia going back to around about 1.6 to 1.8 million years ago.
That does create a problem for the out of Africa theory.
So even that, yeah, is very early.
Cited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very early to have, you know, this population of Homo erectus all the way down in Java and in, you know, around Indonesia. You know, it's, again, it's, you know, it's all problematic when you look at it, you know, like why is this rush of hominins always ending up in Asia? It seems much more like there's this, you know, a bit of two-way, but I think there's some waves that expand out into Africa and also some comings out of Africa, perhaps. You know, I'm not going to say it's impossible. I think perhaps we're looking at some two-way traffic, you know, with people going into Africa, out of Africa, into, you know, Asia, out of Asia. And that, you know, that's the way humans kind of are, that it's never a simple picture, and, you know, that we wander around, you know, we follow, you know, the grass is greener somewhere kind of model at times. So it's not always a simple picture where you can just say, oh, and they did this and they did that, because different groups may have been doing different things. But yeah, the overall picture, yeah, certainly is pointing towards an awful lot going on in Asia. Now, if we sort of, I guess, move on more to the post 1 million years ago, because this is when we start getting into the Homo sapiens part of the story, which I guess is what most of the listeners are really sort of, you know, keen to understand is, you know, how did we come about, you know? And in this case, you know, if we look and we say, okay, so we have a compelling case for hominins, early humans in that region. Certainly, you know, we know they've crossed the Wallace line. So it makes them almost certainly to be in Australia, whether they were already there or whether they crossed into there is sort of irrelevant. We know that they're there. You know, they should be in Australia by a million years ago. So what happens next in the timeline? And that's the fascinating thing, is it's only a bit after this that we see the first signs of a rapid change in early humans. It's dated to around about 900,000 years ago. Between the period of 900,000 to 800,000 years ago, there's a huge change both in the body, you know, of humans, but also in the brain. It's some of the fastest brain expansion is seen. And we now know as well as that, that this is the period when we start to have divergence in the genome, and that we have basically a split, that instead of having these just Homo erectus, we now have the beginnings of Homo sapiens, of Neanderthals, of Denisovans, that they're all splitting apart in the genome around about that 900,000 years ago. And the reason we can support that is because there was a study done up in Spain at a site there called Cima de los Huesos. And the Cima hominins basically were considered at first to be a separate species. They didn't really know what to make of them. Were they Neanderthals? Were they Heidelbergensis? Were they, you know, early sapiens? What were they? But they did this genomic analysis and they managed to extract both mitochondrial and nuclear DNA, which was a first for the nuclear, because it was 500,000 years ago or so these people were alive. So that was really ancient DNA, and they didn't think they would get the nuclear DNA. Thankfully they did, because that gave us a much bigger picture of, you know, who these people were and their ancestry. And what they found was that basically they were early Neanderthals, and that rather than Heidelbergensis and sort of ancestors of, and the Heidelbergensis were considered to be the ancestors of both Neanderthals and us, you know, modern humans. And by looking at the DNA at this site, they found that no, in fact, Neanderthals had been, you know, in existence much longer. And that these Cima hominins were Neanderthals that were already quite far down that Neanderthal path at 500,000 years ago, which meant that they had to take back that divergence event to at least around 700,000 years ago, if not earlier. And there's an argument I've seen, because a couple of academics will say that, you know, it's more like 700,000 to 900,000 years ago. And then a second study was done, which was done by the, I think it's the Indiana University study, which was basically comparative analysis of European hominin fossils, particularly fossil teeth and fossil jaw bones. But they looked at, you know, fossils from right across Europe, and they were searching specifically for evidence of the ancestor of Homo sapiens. So, you know, that was what the goal was. And they eventually concluded that there was no sign of that ancestor anywhere among European hominins. And that all of these hominins instead were related only to Neanderthals. And that's a big problem, because those same, like, supposed Homo heidelbergensis are represented in Africa and are considered to be the best candidate for, you know, the immediate ancestor of Homo sapiens. So once you take them off the board, there is no ancestor in Africa. And that's the current state, which is not being acknowledged much in the media, but that we've lost the only candidate in Africa for the immediate ancestor of humans. We now know that that is basically a Neanderthal relative, and that it did not evolve into Homo sapiens. And that's a big, you know, that's a big problem, because, like, well, if you take it off the board, what do you replace it with? And there is no replacement. They've tried to argue that there's another hominin called Homo ergaster, but a Homo ergaster, no, sorry, is it Homo ergaster? I may have that wrong, but I've forgotten the name now, but there's basically another European hominin which has been argued as a candidate, but it's only found near to the same site in Cima de los Huesos, just up the road in another cave site. And there's some differences in the morphology that suggests it's a bit more modern, and maybe this is the ancestor. But, you know, it's up the road from the other Neanderthal site, you know, and there's another Neanderthal site nearby. Like, let's play some logic here. It's the only place you find it, and all around there is ancestors of Neanderthals. So I'm going to say it's just one of these relatives of Neanderthals as well. And the morphology of the skull is within the tolerance of that species. So it doesn't make a good candidate, and its remains are not found anywhere except for this one site in Spain. So it's not in Africa anyway. So there really isn't a viable candidate at the moment in Africa.
Wow, so they've essentially reached a dead end as far as that goes.
Yes, because, yeah, that's it. You have to say that all you have in Africa now is some archaic Homo sapiens at 200,000 years ago, but with no sign of an ancestry in Africa. That, you know, that's it. It stops there. And this is another problem. Now, do you know where you find these particular fossils? They call the Homo sapiens adaltu. I don't know if you sort of follow this, but do you know where the fossils were found?
No, where?
No, in East Africa, within 300 kilometers of the Bab el Mendab Straits. And the Bab el Mendab Straits are important because they're an easy crossing into Africa. And that is the only place you find these remains. Like, look at the vast continent of Africa.
Yes.
You're going to tell me, like, okay, humans have evolved here, that, you know, they've ranged across Africa, and that they've expanded so much that now they're walking out of Africa, but we only find them in East Africa near to an entry point. You know, it's like, hang on a minute.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
don't you think maybe they crossed into the continent, and that's
an
why we, you know,
it's an inversion of logic is what it is.
It is. Well, it is. So, well, I mean,
we're just getting started here. This has been a fascinating first segment, Bruce. Could you tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you and what your websites are again?
Certainly. Yeah, you can find me at my main site, which is brucefenton.info. And I also have a few articles on my web magazine, which is earth and then the number 4all.net. So if anyone wants, and also with my email, if you have any sort of information you want to share with me, I'm on fenton_bruce@yahoo.co.uk. So if you've got, you know, something relevant to that, then I'll be glad to hear from you.
Well, we're just getting started. If you like what we do here at the Cosmic Switchboard Show and you believe in what we're doing, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.